Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Self-help from the hip.
Small doses.
We're talking that shit.
Small doses.
And keeping it real.
Small doses.
With me and
Nancy.
It's so funky.
Okay, PayPal. You know, I think it's very important to continue to remain worldly. You know, America has a very bad habit of really just closing in on itself and acting like no one else matters and other stories don't matter. It's very annoying. And it's also very reductive. And I feel like it's not just white Americans. Like, the country as it is oftentimes acts as if the only stories that really matter are like American stories. And that is so just myopic, because the world is so much bigger than that. And in my effort to always expand our minds and to expand our conversations, today's guest is from across the pond.
And yes, I am.
It's from across the pond. We've got recording artist Yola with us today. And we are speaking specifically about being a Black British artist. Now, originally, when we connected, Yola, it was about like being a Black artist in general. But I feel like the music industry in England is different than the music industry in America. And I'm very curious to hear about your experience within that space, because I know about the music industry here in America and I don't know about the music industry in England. And also, like, when Black Lives Matter really, not just Black Lives Matter, but like when the conversation around Black life and around George Floyd really exploded last year, there were a lot of British folks that I would see, and both white and Black, that would be like, well, you know, we don't have that problem here in Britain. And, you know, we don't have racism here in Britain. I'm like, y'all literally, like, you made up slavery. Like, what do we you refined chattel slavery. Like, I mean, like, you may have not invented it, but you, like, really worked out the kinks. And so I was like, that's crazy. And I feel like for the most part, the Black people that I know who live in England can expressly give you examples of racism. And if anybody watched Steve McQueen, La Japala Grenada Massive, if everyone watched Steve McQueen's Amazon anthology, Small Axe, it expressly talked about the ways in which Black life in England was affected and it continues to be affected by racism. So, of course, this conversation isn't just about racism, but I know that it has a factor. And and so please give it up for Yola. Yola!
Hey!
Not to be confused with YOLO. Not to be confused with YOLO.
Indeed, YOLA. You only live always.
So please talk to me. I mean, first of all, you know, when you were nominated for Grammys in the 2020 Grammy Awards, it was Americana was the category. And I was like, I don't know what Americana is. Like, I was like, what is this classification? So how do you describe your music?
As musically genre fluid. I've always talked about being across genre, about how the British experience of music has always been less genre-ed, because we were getting everything across the pond from you guys. And so there was this understood, like, reflecting back that Brits would do. And then Americans would get it and they go, oh, that's interesting. We think this. And they'd reflect it back across the pond. And it was just this all the time. But we got everything together. It's not like they decided to import blues and then waited for, like, you know, soul music. It all came on the same ship. And so often the way that we'd absorb music was all together and the radio would reflect that. And so we're really brought up in this kind of culture where we see the connections in music more than necessarily the divisions in music. And so that's why I speak on this kind of concept or this term I've coined of genre fluidity, because it's about my actual environment. Instead of homogenizing maybe to the Black American experience, I'm talking about what it was like to be a pretty isolated, dark-skinned Black girl in a village outside of a city, and the music that I gravitated towards and the environment that I was in sonically. so that I can speak on to the experience of maybe other people that have been isolated while Black. And, and you know.
Isolated and, while Black, yes.
You know, and just been absorbing music and trying to find the kind of their connections to the diaspora, because let's make no mistake, that's what it is, you know? We're connecting back to mama, aka Africa, like via all of these ways, you know? And not that distantly for me, given that I'm like, my heritage is half Ghanaian. And so like, I'm sometimes directly through the kind of the absence of my father, that's my touchstone to the diaspora, through my Bajan mother, that's my touchstone. We have a Bajan.
Oh God, make some flying fish for me now. Just a side note, there was a video recently of Rihanna and Nicki Minaj hanging out, and I have never heard Rihanna really let her Bajan accent out like that, but she really let it out. And I was like, oh my God, but listen to Rihanna doing that Bajan accent. And I know people were like, what is she? Why is she talking like that?
Yeah, so that was my mother.
Bajan accent is very difficult, y'all. It took me years to even get that little bullshit that I just gave you, but a Bajan accent is like real chop, 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 choppy. Anyways.
Yeah, but also always really in the nose as well.
You hear,
Yolanda, your tears are in the air.
But like really shrill. You'd be like, Oh God, it's so early.
I've only been to Barbados one time. I went to Barbados one time and I was like, I don't know if this is my kind of island. It was too flat. It was too flat.
Yeah, it's very flat. Yeah, you know, they call it like Little Britain sometimes because it's kind of, it can be a little, that was like what they tried to kind of curate there,
yes,
you know, in the colonial times.
And there was a lot of like that energy still, like this idea of like white was right. Like I felt like we were getting skipped over for white
tourists. Funny you say that, for real. Like colorism was like a central thing of my mother's life. And so she tried to bleach me. And
what?
For real, when I was a kid. Yes, she tried to freaking bleach me. This melanin, the thing that's going to mean I don't age ever. Like, come on. Why would I want to not have the stuff that makes me eternally youthful? I really don't understand.
But really, anyway, what was her mindset?
Exactly what you said. The white is right mentality is really still there. Mm-hmm. And it like it had really done a number on her. And she was mixed by two mixed parents, if you're mixed ethnicity. And both her granddads were like blonde hair, blue eye. And so like there's this whole like, you know, this is what you should be aspiring towards and the colorism inherent in that. And that's why the first song on the record is about that. It's called Barely Alive. And it's me and another dark-skinned kind of folky person talking about what it's like for us specifically, that whole being played down or being framed in a certain way because of our hue. And all of that starts from a young age, you know? And it's not just this external thing from other ethnic groups. It's within our own ethnic group.
Yes.
That kind of like, you know.
Pervasive. You, it keeps it going.
Yeah, it does. And I really felt that in my mother's generation, my late mother's generation, I should correct to say. And yeah. And so like, I was like, this doesn't feel right. I don't see anything wrong with me, you know. And so like, yeah, I just managed to kind of edge my way out of it. But it was, and that was young. I was like 9 or something. And she's trying to bleach me before I even had the weapons to kind of.
To speak for yourself and to say, this is not what I feel like is. And so, you know, in your music, I'm assuming that it becomes the voice that you didn't have at that time.
Yeah, it does. And as I was saying with this first song, me and co-writer friend Joy Alanakoon, who's doing real great at the moment as well, and we were talking about, you know, this hue and being in this skin and having agency and being seen in all these ways and how you're encouraged so much to survive. Like, surviving is some great, like, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, top tier aspiration for Black women. And I'm like, it's freaking not douchebags. That is foundation. Basic. That's below. It's basic. That is your basic need. That is not self-actualization. But we're encouraged through, you know, this whole bullshit strong Black woman paradigm to aspire to basic. And that's something that comes through a lot in the UK. Because let's be real, like, even Meghan Markle had to turn heel and run, you know? Like, she's like, oh, cool, I'm out. You coming, Harry? Harry's like, you saw how they did dirty on my mother? I'm out of this bitch. Like, and she's passing as fuck.
People over here really didn't realize that, like, that's real. Like, I mean, if you haven't been keeping up with the Britishness of it all, then it may feel like, oh, England is really just Spice Girls and Spice Girls and Harry Potter. And it's like, no, like, the royals are very homogenous, honey. Like, they're not even trying to marry outside of their bloodline, let alone Black folks.
No. And for real, the empire is the thing that we're talking about. All the problems of which we're referring to are the things that extol. And so that's going to be problematic, like, to be involved in. And
yes. Like, that's how I felt from the jump. I was like, how are you going to be in this family when they are a part of continuing and, you know, carrying the torch for the colonialist and the neocolonialist mindset that continues to plague this world? How?
Well, it's...
And then people say, well, love is love. Love is love. I'm like...
Well, you know, Harry was cute. And like...
I couldn't do it. Like, I just know I couldn't do it.
Oh, hell no. But, like, you know, you meet someone, you go, oh, wow, I didn't judge you. I'm quite proud of myself somehow. And then all of a sudden, through the not being massively judgmental, they start being charming and crap. And lo and behold, 18 smashes later, you're like, I think I love this person. Like... Yeah,
but then they have a whole family.
They have the worst family. And hey, we're all terrified about that. I'm single. Like, I know what it's like when you're dating someone. You're like, oh, God, the family. Like, what's this? You know, like, you don't know. There's no guarantee that whoever you're dating.
In her case, she knew the family before she knew him.
Well, this is true. You know that it's a massive... Do you know, that's the one thing none of us have, girl. Like,
I know.
But so you already know they're a nightmare. And you're like... Maybe it's just some blind optimism.
But I really do think... I think she really thought, like, maybe it's not going to be as bad. Or maybe it's not as...
But that's what a lot of people in America think. They think it's not that bad here. And guess what? Like, Brits will perpetuate that. We've got the best PR campaign you've ever seen. Think about it. How the blood clots, sorry, can you?
Hilarious, because I know a lot of people listening didn't even know that blood clot is considered a bad word. But
cool. How the blood clot can you invade a 90 percentile of the planet and still think, oh, but we're the good guys? I don't get it. Like, you literally 90+% out of the planet. What did the 89th percentile think? Ah, they're all right. Like, your PR campaign has to be good.
Right.
And so that's part of the mentality, is that we didn't kill you, therefore we're nice.
Ah!
So we're not going to kill you. We're just going to make you wish you were dead. And I don't know what's worse. Like, have the risk of death, but also the risk of extreme beauty in life, but real death, or not the risk of the beauty of extreme life and the wondrous things, but also because the glass scene is very much like at eyebrow level, but at the same time, but you're not going to die. You're never going to die. You're just going to live
and
in this
work.
BS limbo and work forever. And ever not being seen, not being heard, having your entire reality denied, whilst just humdrumming along in a not even middle, in a just this foundational, you're alive, aren't you? Be grateful. Kind of like, I'm like, I really, like, creating an environment in which you want to jump off a cliff only can't. Because... Like, you know, is that's not a win, guys.
I mean, there's a site in Grenada called Leaper's Hill, where the Carabinarak Indians were like, you know what, we'd rather die than go with you. So they all jumped off the cliff.
It looks like they just ran with that ball and created a whole paradigm around it. And so, like, that's the fight that we fight when it comes to the environment of racism. Like, it's not that, oh, we don't know, we don't have it, we don't know what it is just because we didn't kill you. It's like, no, you've just weaponized misery to a new level. That's all you've done.
I know for me, living in America at this point is becoming more and more difficult to thrive and to strive for creativity, et cetera, because you're just so inundated with the immense efforts that are being put forth every single day to just disseminate misinformation, oppression, discrimination. I mean, we're in the dark ages in America. We are for real in the dark ages. And so I know for me, it's like, it becomes very difficult sometimes to still see like the light within myself as a creative amidst the dark of all of that. So like for you over in England and talking about specifically being a Black woman in this British music business, talk to me about it. Like what makes it work for you? How are you able to make it work?
Well, I moved to America. I'm now in Nashville. So there's that.
Well, Tennessee is a choice.
Oof. Well, but this is what I mean. The fact that I've moved to Tennessee.
And Nashville people say that Nashville is its own energy.
It's the blue. For real, it is. It's not without flaw. And I think anyone in Nashville would go, no, it's not without flaws. We own up to what the flaws are. But moving from where I was in an apparently liberal town on the Southwest to Nashville, Tennessee, and then all of a sudden getting a massive uplift in my career.
Right.
I'm like, guys, what are we doing? What are we doing? Like, we think we're so much better over in the UK. We've got this real stuck up BS kind of vibe. And we could actually be.
if we double down
on any of the stuff that we claim to do, we could really double down on it. But it's the whole kind of so quick to self-congratulate. Oh, we don't have guns.
Right.
We didn't kill them. But the soft round of applause is so quick.
What was the catalyst that made you say it's time to go?
I think for me, I saw some of my girlfriends, some 5'10", 5'11", legs up to their armpits, gorgeous, stone cold single. And I saw all of my friends in the UK, or US, women of color as well. Again, full range, gorgeous smoke shows, just some average looking mofos, and but all in just stable relationships, some coming in and out.
So it wasn't music related. It wasn't business related.
It was both. So it was partly that idea of on the kind of the human side, because it always ties in, one always ties into the other. Make no mistake.
It's
like
true.
Especially with music. And in art, art especially when you're being artistic. Like life reflects art reflects life. And so what I could see in my friends who were musical and weren't musical, who were inexplicably single, just regardless of how smoking hot and intelligent and talented they were. And then going to the US and going, not so much, not seeing that same pattern. And specifically in dark-skinned women, I wasn't seeing that pattern so much in the US. And I was like, okay, this is interesting. Like the pattern still exists and colorism still exists, but it was just less intense than it was in the UK. And then I'd see artists of color that were women and that were dark-skinned, of any background, but that were dark-skinned, speaking on their experience. And you'd see how they did Alexandra Burke. You'd see how they did Jamelia. You'll see we're getting a renaissance, thank the gods, of Laura Mvula, who is just an absolute savant.
I love Laura Mvula.
She's
is there anybody out there?
Genius. Yeah, right.
Who knows?
Yeah.
But she did not have the easy time by any stretch of the imagination. They dropped before they picked up, you know, and like long may she rise as far as I'm concerned. But like every single time it was just like droppity drop. And you see like Michaela will talk about it, how like she'll come over and go, hey, here's my beautiful baby of ideas, and like had some pick up there, but like has to kind of balance the scale with the US to kind of keep things churning. And like, you name it, like Black women will speak on it. Like, and it's Gina Yashere, like wooey. She'll talk on it all day, every day. I love this woman. I can't not. Kelechi, she'll talk on it all day, you know? And like, they're just speaking the truth. There's no lies have been told.
So what has been your experience as an artist in Britain as a Black woman artist? Like, what has made being a Black woman in the British music space positive and negative? Like, give me the scope.
Okay. Great.
Well, let me just tell you this. Here, it's all about image.
Yeah.
Here in America, it's not like your talent, the music, like that's secondary behind your aesthetic and your story. And it's not to say that you have to, you know, have big titties and a fat ass, because you can be Lizzo, which is her own, you know, her own space. You can be Billie Eilish, who's like a little frail white girl, but there has to be a story. And the music, I feel like, comes secondary. I don't know that I feel like it's the same in England.
Well, it's interesting because I felt like it was the other way around. I know, right?
Really?
Yeah, I felt like when I came here, people were finally listening to my music instead of watching my music.
Huh. And so you feel like in England, they were watching your music?
Yeah, that it was like they couldn't conceive of, like, my existence, or they didn't, they'd say, so from, not from, people were ready to hear music. So this is a thing that about England, people are ready to hear music. People are ready to imagine beyond what they've seen already.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes the machine is slow to be at pace with the people. And so the machine will be like, oh, I don't know how to market you. I'm just going to quote all the things I've heard. I don't know how to market you. I'm like, what? My giant boobs and bum too much for you to handle? Yeah, like too much. We don't have cup sizes for all of this. And like, you know, like you do. You've got Bravissimo. Anyway, so like the deal is, was like, it was a lot of this whole, oh, but we don't know what to do with a dark skinned woman. There was just what it was.
Right.
Dark skinned man, fine.
No problem.
No problem. Dark skinned woman, nah. Don't know what to do with it. We don't have a model for it. Like, we don't know who to call. We don't know what to dress you in. We don't know who to, we don't know. It's just the, we don't know whether we can speak on you from the same species point. This is the problem of, and so you'll go in there. And I even had a quote from record company exec saying, oh, come on, no one wants to hear a Black woman sing rock and roll. I'm like, a Black woman invented rock and roll.
What are we talking about?
I'm playing her in a freaking movie. That's how far we're going for
it. Is that a time?
Yeah. What? I'm in the Elvis biopic, and my role is to freaking, like, to be the person that Elvis wakes up every morning, runs back from school to listen to, and is just utterly obsessed, and goes, oh, I'm obsessed with her. Like, yeah, I'm playing that person who then inspires the entire generation of rock and roll and discovers some of them. Like, and so to hear this whole, and I knew about Sister Rosetta Tharpe from a young age. And so for people to be that ignorant, I was like, well,
the
not
boldness.
Holding a lot of hope. I don't, yeah, the caucasity of it all is
yes, the caucasity, you know, of it all. We it's know just, it's so just, well.
It's a bit too rich, that whole kind of, this stuff is mine. I'm like, sweetie, none of this is yours. Like, you know, I don't mean to be the African in the room, but it's all mine. And and so, like, that's,
so you really feel like over here there was just more willing to embrace. Interesting. Do you think part of that is because of the Britishness of it all? Because I do think that. Okay, go ahead.
Sorry, I'm sorry. So hey, British people that are Black. Hi, I'm gonna say the thing, and I'm really sorry to say the thing because I know it's a thing, but I won't be too. I'm going to say it. So I'm sorry. Just a sidebar to Black British people. I'll just go. I'm going. Yeah, 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 yeah. It's just another incarnation of the supremathon. And so then what we have to do is go, you thought we were going to be mild, didn't you? Bad choice.
Really think that they think the accent means that you're going to be like, keep calm and carry on.
Yeah. And they think that we're not going to squat up with Americans who are Black. Like the diaspora isn't like a stone cold sisterhood till we die. I'm like, you don't understand Black women. You need to go back to school. I'm sorry.
I'm very happy to hear that.
This shit don't
die. There's a lot of conversation here about like amongst the in the Hollywood space. You know, there's an ongoing conversation around, you know, Brits playing, you know, legendary Black Americans and iconic Black Americans. And, you know, why aren't those roles being played by actual Black Americans? And I think there's truth in both sides to the argument. Honestly, I think that there's validity in both sides to the conversation. And when you said something just now, supremathon, yo, because I really do think that Americans, they're hearing an accent. And so at first they're just like mesmerized by the accent. I mean, that may be the one time that they really don't see color because they're like, oh, I'm listening.
And she sounds- my God. Oh my God. I love your accent. Oh my God. And just for long enough them to, I don't know, not kill you or, you know, give you an opportunity. Just the split second that you can go, yeah, I got you. Like, if that's what it is. But you'll notice that us Black British people, we don't exactly come quietly.
No, it's true.
We come kind of heavy. We're like second generation Africans, okay? And so, slash Bajans, slash Jamaicans, slash Haitians. I'm like, we're coming early. We're going, oh, no. Like, this isn't like a come quietly, I have no idea what you did to my parents. Or yeah, or whatever, exactly. But this whole, we have no idea what you did to our parents. We know exactly what you did to our parents because of Windrush.
Can you please tell folks what Windrush is? Because I think a lot of folks don't know.
Yeah, okay. So most people my age are second geners, okay? Their parents came over to the UK on a boat called Windrush to relieve the National Health Service because a bunch of people died in the Second World War. And also like the whole kind of those bloodlines, the young kids that were out there fighting, never grew up to be in the civil service, never grew up to do whatever. They went to the colonies, to Barbados, to Nigeria, to India. Ghana, to India, to Pakistan, to draw on people, Jamaica, you know, to draw on people to come to the UK under the illusion of a better life. So let's say that you had a very cheap beachfront small holding in Barbados and you were like, it was just like a little house and you had some chickens and maybe a goat. And like my mother did, or you were in St. Michael, you're in town where she grew up in St. Michael in Barbados. And they go, hey, and they show you a video. So my mum told me this. She goes, it was clearly shot on the one sunny day of the year in England because it rains there all the gosh darn time. So they pick the cutest town on the sunniest day. And then they go, they will love you as you roll onto the sunny shores of England and your money will translate back to blah, blah, blah. Then you can come back to beautiful Barbados and build your dream home and send it back for your parents and your blah, blah. But you go on a one-way ticket. So there's that. So they don't want you to be able to leave.
No.
Number one. So you think we would have learned about English people and boats, but still, no. Anyway, they land. It's not sunny. Everyone hates them. And so then you've got the whole, oh, now I'm stuck here. So you have this, like, what can in some cases become a Stockholm syndrome because you're stuck and you have to deal. or you come from a place where the mentality is of colorism and it just further reinforces the stuff that you've been hearing about as you've been growing up in a colorist environment. And so we see like that kind of bait and switch BS that went on with our parents. And then the large number of people that were promised this like idyllic life and this amazing retirement plan called a superannuation. And there was this mysterious fire that burnt a bunch of people's records that they worked for the NHS, for example. And then it's like, oh, we can't find you, so you can't get your superannuation, which is like many, many multiple times more after 30, 40 years of working in the NHS. My mother never got hers.
So, FYI. And your annuation is your pension.
Yeah, but it's like a pumped up pension for your service. It's like a civil service pension. And like everyone pays towards this kind of national insurance kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like your social security. Like,
yeah, you know. And so, which goes to
and your mother
NHS
never got hers.
Yeah, and a gazillion other black and brown people. None of the whites. So there's that. And so we're coming from this point of view where, like, we're aware of some of the programming that's been going on, or we're aware of, like, the bait and switch from, you know, a place that people go on a holiday to Barbados, for gosh sake. No one goes to on holiday to Hull in the same way they go to, you know, respect to Hull, but like it ain't Barbados. You know it ain't, okay?
What is Hull?
Hull is a place in England that is not Barbados.
Touché.
Yeah, so to be sent to places where like essentially aren't Barbados, I'm like, cool, this isn't fair. And then she'll go, oh, so-and-so went back home and all the beachfront's been bought up by multinational companies and now little Mima's freaking plot ain't there no more. And it was bait and switch. That's all it was. And so we've seen that stuff. And we also, you know, have first-generation Africans that know they go back. I've got friends that go to Lagos to, you know, hang with the friends and turn it up to 11 and like get cocktails and blah, blah. And no one sees images of anywhere in Africa in mainstream media that is like just going out and having cocktails, having a laugh with your mates. It was something that's really
insidious. I didn't realize how tropical it is.
Yeah.
Like and it's like, well, duh, it's equatorial and it's on a coast. But like when I went to Ghana, we went to Cape Coast Castle, which, you know, is its own experience and that you have to do. But then from there, we drove to the beach.
Yes. And there's all these hotels.
Yes.
There's all these hotels. You go up where, like, you know, you have the infinity pool and the floating tray of food.
All of that.
All this business. And I'm just like, you're not showing that part of Africa because you don't want us to know. And again, like, to be like a generation away from that and for those images to be so scant, I was like, I grew up my entire adult life up until, I don't know, late 20s, none of that. And so many people going, oh, there's nothing over there and blah, blah. I'm like, we are one generation from that. Like, how the heck is the PR campaign for where I come from so bad and the PR campaign for here so good? And that's just what it is. It's psychological. So yes, the musical, so the experience of your sense of agency, like you've got to go through a psychological reckoning to be able to do what I'm doing now, writing songs, being in spaces where there might be a lot of older white guys and going, actually, I want these people to be involved because I want it to reflect my world. It takes strength to be able to do that, but not the kind of like emotionless monolith freaking black lady strength. I'm talking like belief and love in yourself, not like freaking robo freaking black lady. And so to build that, you need people that see you. And if people are so convinced that they haven't been mentally programmed, they won't see that they don't see you. And so the work that you have to do to just build a squad around you who see you enough to just let you do what you're going to do without being so threatened that they want to sabotage what you do or just not believe it's even possible. And that's kind of half of the battle is with people's psychologies. I was terrified to lead. I was terrified to ask anyone to do anything for me because I honestly didn't believe anyone would want to do anything for a Black lady. And I hadn't seen evidence of it. And so,
right,
what am I going to do?
It's like, why waste my time? Why waste my energy?
It's not even waste. It's just fear of being left out in the cold. And I've been left out in the cold by people that claim to be friends. Like, I've been left on the street to
literally
die.
Left on the street.
To die. By people that were like, now we got you. I'm like, you don't got me. I'm literally in a bag, in a bush, on the street. And you're like, I'm sorry, it's just inconvenient, you know. Like, you've got to work to find people that are, you know, your squad. Like, for real.
And in this business in particular. What was your path from saying, I want to do music to then doing music professionally? Because, and also like
the birth
in
canal.
This particular style, because your style of music is not, I feel like what would have been the, I guess like the path, the road most taken, right? Because it's like,
no.
You have a soulful voice. It's like, oh, so just do R&B, call it a day.
Yeah. But I don't really have the R&B voice. So that's the trick. I grow up listening to like Mary, and I think, oh, maybe I can get on this. Because, you know, Mary's voice has got all the,
Yeah, nah.
And I'm like, maybe I can get in on there. And then I hear a lot, I hear your Leahs and your Brandys and my, but I'm like, oh, I can't just be Mary.
But I just feel like people just look at Black women and they're like, these are your lanes. And even though you said like Brit, like your style is more genre fluid, even though you're saying that you had a fear of leading, you were leading by just saying, you know, I'm going to sing different than what I think they would expect.
I think that's it. I think what I ended up doing was trying to lead through genre freedom more than like putting myself out there on my own. And so I would be like, Tina, like, listen to that woman. She's got everything in her voice. Mm-hmm. I'm like, that feels real to me. Aretha, she didn't just hang around in one genre getting all bored and stuff. She moved around. She had some fun with it, you know? Like, right up until she was crystalline till her dying day, you know? Like, I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm here for that stuff. Can we talk about Shaka? She moved around a few genres before she settled on anything and was a drummer and a badass drummer at that. Can we speak on that?
Like, Shaka can drum?
Yeah, for real.
I didn't know that.
Now you know why her vocals so pocket, you know? Drummer.
All right.
Yeah, fluent German speaker as well.
Shaka Khan?
For real. I've spoken fluent German with her. She lived in Germany for like a long time.
Are you a German speaker?
I had a place there anyway. Yeah, and French.
Why?
I'm a nerd.
I mean, you just casually just said that you're trilingual, and I'm sure there's another one in there too.
Not really. I understand loads of other things, though, without being able to speak them because of their proximity to Germanic or Latin languages. Or romantic languages, should I say.
Would you consider yourself a polyglot or were you just trained in these languages in school?
I've got a good ear. That's probably the thing. It was school though, like 100%. But then I just decided to kind of spend some time in the south of France doing gigs. And those gigs meant that I was immersed. And so that helped that. And then I just had some German friends. But my ear is the thing that, so it's my musical ear kind of took itself to understanding just to hearing things. And I can still do that with languages I don't speak. I'll be like, yeah, I know what you said. And like, I went through a little phase doing interviews where they'd ask me in the language I don't speak and I'd answer in English accurately.
Nice. that is so impressive. A language is something, like I have a good ear for sound, so I can do the accent. But in terms of like, the synthesizing of meaning, like I'm just not as, I wish I had it in a way that people like you have it. Like I can get by with French. I can get by even more. I can really get by with Spanish, but like German just sounds so weird to me that I don't even know that I would ever be able to get there. Cause I went to Berlin and was like, what is this?
Yeah. It's just because it's next door for all intents and purposes to a Brit. Like France and Germany aren't as far. And so,
right.
Whereas maybe Spain's a bit further. And so you're going to pick up French and German and anything that's just kind of nearby and spoken in a few countries. And so it's more proximity. School does that. They kind of, they give you a choice. They only started doing Spanish in my school, like later on as well. So we didn't have as much like exposure to it. But yeah, like what ends up happening? So like my experience is this being all of this stuff. And being this nerd. And they're like, oh, we don't understand nerdery in black skins. I'm like, oh, what am I going to do with my blurred life? I don't know. And so, yeah, I chose genre as a way to kind of be free and to speak on Tina and Sister Rosetta and Aretha and Mavis Staples and Etta and Ella and their freedom of expression and their flow. Like, I don't think it's much of a mystery that you can hear a number of those in my voice, but maybe all of my influences are more of my mother's record collection and then a little bit of Mary.
Mary always finds her way in.
She should, because she's awesome. And so, like, I was, I still am all about Mary. I saw the documentary. I cried my eyeballs out. Did you cry? I cried. I could not cry.
I did. I honestly, I couldn't finish it.
I took a pause.
It was heavy.
It was freaking heavy. It was so heavy.
I was not prepared for that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was like on tour and then I kind of come out of my hotel room. They're like, are you okay? I'm like, I'm not okay.
I'm not. Well, we are so happy to be hosting you here in America.
Hey, it's really nice. I'm not sure what you've done with the place. You know, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of lit though. It's like the best stuff, the worst stuff, and literally everything in between. And that's how I understand this place. Awesome stuff, dreadful stuff, all the permutations you could possibly imagine. And it's just a little... You know, it's like you're on a dodgem car just trying to get through to the good shit. Is that the good shit? Cool. And that's the life experience. And if you're lucky, you don't get like freaking whack-a-mole. And, you know.
Touche.
I'm here to run the gauntlet. It's better than freaking misery.
You know what? And you laying out what it is over in Britain, you know, I think that's really just a great way for us to understand just the difference. And like being a Black woman in that musical space, you're not going to thrive. Like you're not going to feel full.
It's psychological what they do. So even if they choose, let's say that you're lucky, 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 and they choose you as their kind of proof. We're not racist. We have this one, like cognitive bias will always out.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's your unconscious programming.
Yeah,
you've been programmed by an entire system. And so mentally at some point, even if you think you're immune, the second you think you're immune, that's when you've got a problem. And so the problem is that there aren't enough people going, we've got a massive problem and we need to be vigilant of it every second of our lives. People are waiting for that moment where they can exhale and get the badge that says they're not a racist. And as long as that's the case, as long as it's like, oh, we don't talk about those things. One doesn't talk about those things, darling. Like, you know, as long as we're in that, we've got problems. And they're problems of the ability for people that look like me with my skill set to thrive. And I can literally just go, come back and go, oh, cool, you're really good at that. I'm like, so it's not that they haven't got any taste. Brits have great taste. And so they'll be like, you're really good. I'll be like, yeah, guy. Cool. Glad you see it now. Cool. So these kids, there's a little dark girl over there and she's a badass. And you're literally like.
Right.
The whole time. Like you need to stop doing that.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
And so that's what it is. And, you know, US ain't freaking innocent by any stretch of the imagination.
No, but like this country is completely complicit in that same behavior.
Yeah, but I think we talk about that somewhat kind of openly. We go, yeah.
Whereas I think depending on the circle, I think the trouble is that like, The walls are very, you're right. Like, I definitely feel like in England, there's a definite pretending that these things do not exist. Here, that still takes place. I mean, it just depends on the circle you're in. It could feel like, oh, we all get it. But then you see other circles that are very adamantly saying like, no, racism is not a real thing. Privilege is not a real thing. Colorism is not a real thing. All of you guys are bullshitting. You know, you have your own show and this person has their own show. So how can racism exist? And to your point, at the end of the day, people still want to be entertained. So there's no shortage of white people who don't like black people, but are willing to be entertained by them. Like that's an absolute normal paradigm. So I think
that 100%.
Yeah. I mean, that's literally a basis of an entire industry. Like industries are built, have been built on that. So, but I really thank you for joining us today and just talking to us from a different perspective, because it's so important. And I'm telling you, there's a stronghold here. And I'm sure as you've been here, you see it. Like you're not hearing anything about England while you're here. Like no. from other Americans.
No. Like,
it's a it's an iron curtain. Like, I mean, they definitely do a great job here of tricking America. The same way you were saying, like, Britain has tricked itself into being the good guy, even though they have invaded 90% of the world. It's like America has tricked itself into being the smartest person in the room, even though they're the only ones in the room.
Yeah.
And so that's been like a real thing that I'm working to combat in a number of ways. And I just feel like by having people like you come and you know, speaking on your experiences beyond just the ones that we are individually like experiencing, like you can relate on a Pan-African level. People who are listening to this episode can relate on a diasporic level.
Yes, like 100%. I think that's the most important takeaway from all of this as the diaspora. Connection is our power. Anyone that has managed to convince you that your brothers and sisters are inferior for whatever reason has won.
Yep.
That's just it. That's just it. And it can be in any way. You can say it's down to the people that you want to work with or the people that you want to hang with or whatever. Like the second that they've driven a barrier up between you and other said group of diasporic people and said, oh, it's them instead of you or blah, mm-hmm. blah. Like we're not about that, FYI. No, like from the Black British point of view, we are not about that. The diaspora is not about that. And you're not about to do a brand new brand of pitching us against each other where you try and turn Black British people against Black American people, because that's already not working, FYI. And if you're coming at Black women thinking that we're not going to support each other, you're high.
Well, people, you can support Yola's last album, Stand For Myself, and any new music coming soon?
That just came out.
I don't know, people, but these days it feels like new music comes every goddamn month. It's like,
it does. I can't
live, because that just came out in July, but people are like, okay, we're done.
We're cooking something. So find me on I Am Yola Official on Instagram, because I have a feeling we might be announcing something new, but I can't say what, because I haven't checked.
All right.
The Last Dose.
Well, this has been such a delight.
It's been lovely. I think we should get drinks or something and freaking yes. turn this into a real world situation. This Zoom thing can break my heart sometimes. But hey.
Zoom is, at this point, I've just given myself over to it. So it is. I can't even fight it anymore. So I'm just trying to make the best of it. And stay out there in Nashville. Make the best of your American experience and keep doing what you're doing and breaking the walls of these genres.
Thank you so much. This has been such a joy. Thank you.
Thank you, Yola.
Starburns Audio, a podcast. A podcast network.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.